and Andy, mistaking his smile for mockery, changed directions again. "There's something incredibly arrogant about your stubbornness, Jude," he continued. "Your utter refusal to listen to anyone about anything that concerns your health or well-being is either a pathological case of self-destructiveness or it's a huge fuck you to the rest of us." He was hurt by this. "And there's something incredibly manipulative about you threatening to commit me whenever I disagree with you, and especially in this case, when I've told you it was a stupid accident," he hurled back at Andy. "Andy, I appreciate you. I really do. I don't know what I'd do without you. But I'm an adult, and you can't dictate what I do or don't do." "You know what, Jude?" Andy had asked. Now he was yelling again. "You're right. I can't dictate your decisions. But I don't have to accept them either. Go find some other asshole to be your doctor. I'm not going to do it any longer." "Fine," he'd snapped, and left. He couldn't remember when he had been angrier on his own behalf. Lots of things made him angry. General injustice, incompetence, directors who didn't give Willem a part he wanted. But he rarely got angry about things that happened or had happened to him. His pains, past and present, were things he tried not to brood about, were not questions to which he spent his days searching for meaning. He already knew why they had happened. They had happened because he had deserved them. But he knew, too, that his anger was unjustified, and as much as he resented his dependence upon Andy, he was grateful for him as well, and he knew Andy found his behavior illogical. But Andy's job was to make people better. Andy saw him the way he saw a mangled tax law, as something to be untangled and repaired. Whether he thought he could be repaired was almost incidental. The thing he was trying to fix, the scars that raised his back into an awful, unnatural topography, the skin stretched as glossy and taut as a roasted duck's, the reason he was trying to save money, was not, he knew, something Andy would approve of. "Jude," Andy would say, if he ever heard what he was planning, "I promise you it's not going to work, and you're going to have wasted all that money. Don't do it." "But they're hideous," he would mumble. "They're not, Jude," Andy would say. "I swear to God they're not." But he wasn't going to tell Andy anyway, so he would never have to have that particular conversation. The days passed, and he didn't call Andy, and Andy didn't call him. As if in punishment, his wrist throbbed at night when he was trying to sleep, and at work he forgot and banged it rhythmically against the side of his desk as he read, a long-time bad tick he'd not managed to erase. The stitches had seeped blood then, and he'd had to clean them, clumsily, in the bathroom sink. "What's wrong?" Willem asked him one night. "Nothing," he said. He could tell Willem, of course, who would listen and say, "Hmm," in his Willemish way, but he knew he would agree with Andy. A week after their fight, he came home to Lispenard Street. It was a Sunday, and he had been walking through West Chelsea, and Andy was waiting on the steps before their front door. He was surprised to see him. "Hi," he said. "Hi," Andy had replied. They stood there. "I wasn't sure if you'd take my call." "Of course I would have." "Listen," Andy said. "I'm sorry."
"Me too. I'm sorry, Andy.
But I really do think you should see someone."
"I know you do."
And somehow they managed to leave it at that, a fragile and mutually unsatisfying ceasefire, with the question of the therapist, the vast, gray, demilitarized zone between them. The compromise, though how this had been agreed upon as such was unclear to him now, was that at the end of every visit he had to show Andy his arms, and Andy would examine them for new cuts. Whenever he found one, he would log it in his chart. He was never sure what might provoke another outburst from Andy. Sometimes there were many new cuts, and Andy would merely groan and write them down, and sometimes there were only a few new cuts, and Andy would get agitated anyway.
"You fucking ruined your arms, you know that, right?" he would ask him.
But he would say nothing and let Andy's lecture wash over him. Part of him understood that by not letting Andy do his job, which was, after all, to heal him, he was being disrespectful and was to some degree making Andy into a joke in his own office. Andy's tallies. Sometimes he wanted to ask Andy if he would get a prize once he reached a certain number, but he knew it would make him angry. Were a way for him to at least pretend he could manage the situation, even if he couldn't. It was the accrual of data as a small compensation for actual treatment. And then, 2 years later, another wound had opened on his left leg, which had always been the more troublesome one, and his cuttings were set aside for the more urgent matter of his leg. He had first developed one of these wounds less than a year after the injury, and it had healed quickly. "But it won't be the last," the Philadelphia surgeon had said. "With an injury like yours, everything, the vascular system, the dermal system, has been so compromised that you should expect you might get these now and again." This was the 11th he'd had, so although he was prepared for the sensation of it, he was never to know its cause. An insect bite? A brush against the edge of a metal filing cabinet? It was always something so gallingly small, but still capable of tearing his skin as easily as if it had been made of paper. And he was never to cease being disgusted by it. The suppuration, the sick, fishy scent, the little gash, like a fetus's mouth that would appear, burbling viscous, unidentifiable fluids. It was unnatural, the stuff of monster movies and myths, to walk about with an opening that wouldn't, couldn't be closed. He began seeing Andy every Friday night so he could debride the wound, cleaning it and removing the dead tissue and examining the area around it, looking for new skin growth, as he held his breath and gripped the side of the table and tried not to scream. "You have to tell me when it's painful, Jude," Andy had said, as he breathed and sweated and counted in his head. "It's a good thing if you can feel this, not a bad thing. It means the nerves are still alive and still doing what they're supposed to." "It's painful," he managed to choke out. "Scale of 1 to 10? 7? 8? "I'm sorry," Andy replied. "I'm almost done, I promise. 5 more minutes." He shut his eyes and counted to 300, making himself go slowly. When it was over, he would sit, and Andy would sit with him and give him something to drink. A soda, something sugary, and he'd feel the room begin to clarify itself around him, bit by blurry bit. "Slowly," Andy would say, "or you'll be sick." He would watch as Andy dressed the wound. He was always at his calmest when he was stitching or sewing or wrapping, and in those moments he would feel so vulnerable and weak that he would have agreed to anything Andy might have suggested. "You're not going to cut yourself on your legs," Andy would say, more a statement than a question. "No, I won't, because that would be too insane, even for you." "I know." "Your anatomy is so degraded that it'd get really infected." "Andy, I know." He had, at various points, suspected that Andy was talking to his friends behind his back, and there were times when they would use Andy-like language and turns of phrase, and even 4 years after the incident, as Andy had begun calling it, he suspected that Willem was going through the bathroom trash in the morning, and he'd had to take extra cautions disposing of his razors, bundling them in tissue and duct tape and throwing them into garbage cans on the way to work. "Your crew," Andy called them. "What have you and your crew been up to these days?" when he was in a good mood. And, "I'm going to tell your fucking crew they've got to keep their eyes on you," when he wasn't. "Don't you dare, Andy," he'd say. "And anyway, it's not their responsibility." "Of course it is," Andy would retort. As with other issues, they couldn't agree on this one. But now it was 20 months after the appearance of this most recent wound, and it still hadn't healed. Or rather, it had healed and then broken again and then healed again, and then he had woken on Friday and felt something damp and gummy on his leg, the lower calf, right above the ankle, and had known it had split. He hadn't called Andy yet. He would do so on Monday. But it had been important to him to take this walk, which he feared would be his last for some time, maybe months. He was on Madison and 75th now, very near Andy's office, and his leg was hurting him so much that he crossed to 5th and sat down on one of the benches near the wall that bordered the park. As soon as he sat, he experienced that familiar dizziness, that stomach-lifting nausea, and he bent over and waited until the cement became cement again and he would be able to stand. He felt in those minutes his body's treason, how sometimes the central, tedious struggle in his life was his unwillingness to accept that he would be betrayed by it again and again, that he could expect nothing from it and yet had to keep maintaining it. So much time, his and Andy's, was spent trying to repair something unfixable, something that should have wound up in charred bits on a slag heap years ago. And for what? His mind, he supposed. But there was, as Andy might have said, something incredibly arrogant about that, as if he was saving a jalopy because he had a sentimental attachment to its sound system. If I walk just a few more blocks, I can be at his office, he thought. But he never would have. It was Sunday. Andy deserved some sort of respite from him. And besides, what he was feeling now was not something he hadn't felt before. He waited a few more minutes and then heaved himself to his feet, where he stood for half a minute before dropping to the bench again. Finally, he was able to stand for good. He wasn't ready yet, but he could imagine himself walking to the curb, raising his arm to hail a cab, resting his head against the back of its black vinyl banquette. He would count the steps to get there, just as he would count the steps it would take him to get from the cab and to his building, from the elevator to the apartment, and from the front door to his room. When he had learned to walk the third time, after his braces had come off, it had been Andy who'd helped instruct the physical therapist. She had not been pleased, but had taken his suggestions. And Andy, who had, as Anna had just 4 years before, watched him make his way unaccompanied across a space of 10 feet, and then 20, and then 50, and then 100. His very gait, the left leg coming up to make a near 90-degree angle with the ground, forming a rectangle of negative space, the right listing behind, was engineered by Andy, who had made him work at it for hours until he could do it himself. It was Andy who told him he thought he was capable of walking without a cane, and when he finally did it, he'd had Andy to thank. Monday was not very many hours away, he told himself, as he struggled to stay standing, and Andy would see him as he always did, no matter how busy he was. When did you notice the break? Andy would say, nudging gently at it with a bit of gauze. Friday, he'd say. Why didn't you call me then, Jude? Andy would say, irritated. At any rate, I hope you didn't go on your stupid fucking walk. No, of course not, he'd say. But Andy wouldn't believe him. He sometimes wondered whether Andy thought of him as only a collection of viruses and malfunctions. If you removed them, who was he? If Andy didn't have to take care of him, would he still be interested in him? If he appeared one day magically whole, with a stride as easy as Willem's and JB's complete lack of self-consciousness, the way he could lean back in his chair and let his shirt hoist itself from his hips without any fear, or with Malcolm's long arms, the skin on their insides as smooth as frosting, what would he be to Andy? What would he be to any of them? Would they like him less? More? Or would he discover, as he often feared, that what he understood as friendship was really motivated by their pity of him? How much of who he was inextricable from what he was unable to do? Who would he have been? Who would he be without the scars, the cuts, the hurts, the sores, the fractures, the infections, the splints, and the discharges? But of course, he would never know. 6 months ago, they had managed to get the wound under control, and Andy had examined it, checking and rechecking, before issuing a fleet of warnings about what he should do if it reopened. He had been only half listening. He was feeling light that day for some reason, but Andy was querulous, and along with a lecture about his leg, he had also endured another about his cutting. Too much, Andy thought, and his general appearance. Too thin, Andy thought. He had admired his leg, pivoting it and examining the place where the wound had at last closed over, as Andy talked and talked. "Are you listening to me, Jude?" he had finally demanded.
"It looks good," he told Andy,
not answering him, but wanting his reassurance.
"Doesn't it?"
Andy sighed. "It looks..." And then he stopped and was quiet, and he had looked up, had watched Andy shut his eyes, as if refocusing himself, and then open them again. "It looks good, Jude," he'd said, quietly. "It does." He had felt then a great surge of gratitude, because he knew Andy didn't think it looked good, would never think it looked good. To Andy, his body was an onslaught of terrors, one against which the two of them had to be constantly attentive. He knew Andy thought he was self-destructive, or delusional, or in denial. But what Andy never understood about him was this. He was an optimist. Every month, every week, he chose to open his eyes, to live another day in the world. He did it when he was feeling so awful that sometimes the pain seemed to transport him to another state, one in which everything, even the past that he worked so hard to forget, seemed to fade into a gray watercolor wash. He did it when his memories crowded out all other thoughts, when it took real effort, real concentration to tether himself to his current life, to keep himself from raging with despair and shame. He did it when he was so exhausted of trying, when being awake and alive demanded such energy that he had to lie in bed thinking of reasons to get up and try again, when it would be much easier to go to the bathroom and untape the plastic zipped bag containing his cotton pads and loose razors and alcohol wipes and bandages from its hiding place beneath the sink and simply surrender. Those were the very bad days. It really had been a mistake that night before New Year's Eve when he sat in the bathroom drawing the razor across his arm. He had been half asleep still. He was normally never so careless. But when he realized what he had done, there had been a minute, 2 minutes, he had counted, when he genuinely hadn't known what to do, when sitting there and letting this accident become its own conclusion seemed easier than making the decision himself, a decision that would ripple past him to include Willem and Andy and days and months of consequences. He hadn't known, finally, what had compelled him to grab his towel from its bar and wrap it around his arm, and then pull himself to his feet and wake Willem up. But with each minute that passed, he moved further and further from the other option, the events unfolding themselves with a speed he couldn't control. And he longed for that year right after the injury, before he met Andy, when it seemed that everything might be improved upon, and that his future self might be something bright and clean, when he knew so little, but had such hope, and faith that his hope might one day be rewarded. Before New York, there had been law school, and before that, college, and before that, there was Philadelphia, and the long, slow trip across country, and before that, there was Montana and the boys' home. And before Montana was the Southwest, and the motel rooms, and the lonely stretches of road, and the hours spent in the car. And before that was South Dakota, and the monastery. And before that, a father and a mother, presumably. Or, more realistically, simply a man and a woman. And then, probably, just a woman. And then him. It was Brother Peter, who taught him math and was always reminding him of his good fortune, who told him he'd been found in a garbage can. Inside a trash bag,
stuffed with eggshells and old lettuce and spoiled spaghetti, and you, Brother Peter said, in the alley behind the drugstore, you know the one. Even though he didn't, as he rarely left the monastery. Later, Brother Michael claimed this wasn't even true. You weren't in the trash bin, he told him. You were next to the trash bin. Yes, he conceded, there had been a trash bag, but he had been atop it, not in it, and at any rate, who knew what was in the trash bag itself, and who cared? More likely it was things thrown away from the pharmacy, cardboard and tissues and twist ties and packing chips. You mustn't believe everything Brother Peter says, he reminded him, as he often did, along with, you mustn't indulge this tendency to self-mythologize, as he said whenever he asked for details of how he'd come to live at the monastery. You came, and you're here now, and you should concentrate on your future and not on the past. They had created the past for him. He was found naked, said Brother Peter, or in just a diaper, said Brother Michael. But either way, it was assumed he'd been left to, as they said, let nature have its way with him, because it was mid-April and still freezing, and a newborn couldn't have survived for long in that weather. He must have been there for only a few minutes, however, because he was still almost warm when they found him, and the snow hadn't yet filled the car's tire tracks, nor the footprints, sneakers, probably a woman's size 8, that led to the trash bin and then away from it. He was lucky they had found him. It was fate they had found him. Everything he had, his name, his birthday, itself an estimate, his shelter, his very life, was because of them. He should be grateful. They didn't expect him to be grateful to them. They expected him to be grateful to God. He never knew what they might answer and what they might not. A simple question, had he been crying when they found him? Had there been a note? Had they looked for whoever had left him? Would be dismissed or unknown or unexplained, but there were declarative answers for the more complicated ones. The state couldn't find anyone to take you, Brother Peter again, and so we said we'd keep you here as a temporary measure, and then months turned into years, and here you are. The end. Now finish these equations. You're taking all day. But why couldn't the state find anyone? Theory one, beloved of Brother Peter, there were simply too many unknowns, his ethnicity, his parentage, possible congenital health problems, and on and on. Where had he come from? Nobody knew. None of the local hospitals had recorded a recent live birth that matched his description, and that was worrisome to potential guardians. Theory two, Brother Michael's, this was a poor town in a poor region in a poor state. No matter the public sympathy, and there had been sympathy, he wasn't to forget that, it was quite another thing to add an extra child to one's household, especially when one's household was already so stretched. Theory three, Father Gabriel's, he was meant to stay here. It had been God's will. This was his home. And now he needed to stop asking questions. Then there was a fourth theory, invoked by almost all of them when he misbehaved. He was bad, and had been bad from the beginning. You must have done something very bad to be left behind like that, Brother Peter used to tell him after he hit him with the board, rebuking him as he stood there, sobbing his apologies. Maybe you cried so much they just couldn't stand it any longer. And he'd cry harder, fearing that Brother Peter was correct. For all their interest in history, they were collectively irritated when he took interest in his own, as if he was persisting in a particularly tiresome hobby that he wasn't outgrowing at a fast enough rate. Soon he learned not to ask, or at least not to ask directly, although he was always alert to stray pieces of information that he might learn in unlikely moments, from unlikely sources. With Brother Michael, he read Great Expectations, and managed to misdirect the brother into a long segue about what life for an orphan would be like in 19th-century London, a place as foreign to him as Pierre, just 100-some miles away. The lesson eventually became a lecture, as he knew it would. But from it, he did learn that he, like Pip, would have been given to a relative if there were any to be identified or had. So there were none, clearly. He was alone. His possessiveness was also a bad habit that needed to be corrected. He couldn't remember when he first began coveting something that he could own, something that would be his and no one else's. "No one here owns anything," they told him. But was that really true? He knew that Brother Peter had a tortoiseshell comb, for example, the color of freshly tapped tree sap and just as light-filled, of which he was very proud and with which he brushed his mustache every morning. One day the comb disappeared, and Brother Peter had interrupted his history lesson with Brother Matthew to grab him by the shoulders and shake him, yelling that he had stolen the comb and had better return it if he knew what was good for him. Father Gabriel later found the comb, which had slipped into the shallow wedge of space between the brother's desk and the radiator. And Brother Matthew had an original cloth-bound edition of the Bostonians, which had a soft-rubbed green spine, and which he once held before him so he could look at its cover. "Don't touch! I said don't touch!" Even Brother Luke, his favorite of the brothers, who rarely spoke and never scolded him, had a bird that all the others considered his. Technically, said Brother David, the bird was no one's, but it had been Brother Luke who had found it and nursed it and fed it and to whom it flew, and so if Luke wanted it, Luke could have it. Brother Luke was responsible for the monastery's garden and greenhouse, and in the warm months he would help him with small tasks. He knew from eavesdropping on the other brothers that Brother Luke had been a rich man before he came to the monastery, but then something had happened, or he had done something, it was never clear which, and he either lost most of his money or gave it away, and now he was here, just as poor as the others, although it was Brother Luke's money that had paid for the greenhouse and which helped defray some of the monastery's operating expenses. Something about the way the other brothers mostly avoided Luke made him think he might be bad, although Brother Luke was never bad, not to him. It was shortly after Brother Peter accused him of stealing his comb that he actually stole his first item, a package of crackers from the kitchen. He was passing by one morning on the way to the room they had set aside for his schooling, and no one was there, and the package was on the countertop, just within his reach, and he had, on impulse, grabbed it and run, stuffing it under the scratchy wool tunic he wore, a miniature version of the brother's own. He had detoured so he could hide it under his pillow, which had made him late for class with Brother Matthew, who had hit him with a Forsythius switch as punishment. But the secret of its existence filled him with something warm and joyous. That night, alone in bed, he ate one of the crackers, which he didn't even really like, carefully, breaking it into 8 sections with his teeth and letting each piece sit on his tongue until it became soft and gluey and he could swallow it whole. After that, he stole more and more. There was nothing in the monastery he really wanted, nothing that was really worth having, and so he simply took what he came across, with no real plan or craving. Food, when he could find it, a clacky black button he found on the floor of Brother Michael's room in one of his post-breakfast prowlings, a pen from Father Gabriel's desk, snatched when, mid-lecture, the father had turned from him to find a book, Brother Peter's comb. This last was the only one he planned, but it gave him no greater thrill than the others. He stole matches and pencils and pieces of paper, useless junk, but someone else's junk, shoving them down his underwear and running back to his bedroom to hide them under his mattress, which was so thin that he could feel its every spring beneath his back at night. "Stop that running around or I'll have to beat you," Brother Matthew would yell at him as he hurried to his room.
"Yes, brother,"
he would reply, and make himself slow to a walk. It was the day he took his biggest prize that he was caught. Father Gabriel's silver lighter, stolen directly off his desk when he'd had to interrupt his lecturing of him to answer a phone call. Father Gabriel had bent over his keyboard, and he had reached out and grabbed the lighter, palming its cool, heavy weight in his hand until he was finally dismissed. Once outside the father's office, he had hurriedly pushed it into his underwear and was walking as quickly as he could back to his room when he turned the corner without looking and ran directly into Brother Pavel. Before the brother could shout at him, he had fallen back and the lighter had fallen out, bouncing against the flagstones. He had been beaten, of course, and shouted at, and in what he thought was a final punishment, Father Gabriel had called him into his office and told him that he would teach him a lesson about stealing other people's things. He had watched, uncomprehending, but so frightened that he couldn't even cry, as Father Gabriel folded his handkerchief to the mouth of a bottle of olive oil and then rubbed the oil into the back of his left hand. And then he had taken his lighter, the same one he had stolen, and held his hand under the flame until the greased spot had caught fire and his whole hand was swallowed by a white, ghostly glow. Then he had screamed and screamed, and the father had hit him in the face for screaming.
"Stop that shouting," he'd shouted. "This is what you get. You'll never forget not to steal again."
When he regained consciousness, he was back in his bed, and his hand was bandaged. All of his things were gone. The stolen things, of course, but the things he had found on his own as well. The stones and feathers and arrowheads, and the fossil that Brother Luke had given him for his 5th birthday, the first gift he had ever received. After that, after he was caught, he was made to go to Father Gabriel's office every night and take off his clothes, and the father would examine inside him for any contraband. And later, when things got worse, he would think back to that package of crackers. If only he hadn't stolen them. If only he hadn't made things so bad for himself. His rages began after his evening examinations with Father Gabriel, which soon expanded to include midday ones with Brother Peter. He would have tantrums, throwing himself against the stone walls of the monastery and screaming as loudly as he could, knocking the back of his damaged, ugly hand, which, 6 months later, still hurt sometimes, a deep, insistent pulsing, against the hard, mean corners of the wooden dinner tables, banging the back of his neck, his elbows, his cheeks, all the most painful, tender parts, against the side of his desk. He had them in the day and at night. He couldn't control them. He would feel them move over him like a fog and let himself relax into them, his body and voice moving in ways that excited and repelled him. For as much as he hurt afterward, he knew it scared the brothers, that they feared his anger and noise and power. They hit him with whatever they could find. They started keeping a belt looped on a nail on the schoolroom wall. They took off their sandals and beat him for so long that the next day he couldn't even sit. They called him a monster. They wished for his death. They told him they should have left him on the garbage bag. And he was grateful for this, too, for their help exhausting him, because he couldn't lasso the beast himself, and he needed their assistance to make it retreat, to make it walk backward into the cage until it freed itself again. He started wetting his bed and was made to go visit the father more often for more examinations, and the more examinations the father gave him, the more he wet the bed. The father began visiting him in his room at night, and so did Brother Peter, and later Brother Matthew, and he got worse and worse. They made him sleep in his wet nightshirt. They made him wear it during the day. He knew how badly he stank, like urine and blood, and he would scream and rage and howl, interrupting lessons, pushing books off tables, so that the brothers would have to start hitting him right away, the lesson abandoned. Sometimes he was hit hard enough so that he lost consciousness, which is what he began to crave. That blackness, where time passed and he wasn't in it, where things were done to him, but he didn't know it. Sometimes there were reasons behind his rages, although they were reasons known only to him. He felt so ceaselessly dirty, so soiled, as if inside he was a rotten building, like the condemned church he had been taken to see in one of his rare trips outside the monastery. The beams speckled with mold, the rafters splintered and holy with nests of termites, the triangles of white sky showing immodestly through the ruined rooftop. He had learned in a history lesson about leeches, and how many years ago they had been thought to siphon the unhealthy blood out of a person, sucking the disease foolishly and greedily into their fat, wormy bodies, and he had spent his free hour, after classes, but before chores, wading in the stream on the edge of the monastery's property, searching for leeches of his own. And when he couldn't find any, when he was told there weren't any in that creek, he screamed and screamed until his voice deserted him. And even then he couldn't stop. Even when his throat felt like it was filling itself with hot blood. Once he was in his room, and both Father Gabriel and Brother Peter were there, and he was trying not to shout, because he had learned that the quieter he was, the sooner it would end. And he thought he saw, passing outside the doorframe, quick as a moth, Brother Luke, and had felt humiliated, although he didn't know the word for humiliation then. And so, the next day he had gone in his free time to Brother Luke's garden and had snapped off every one of the daffodils' heads, piling them at the door of Luke's gardener's shed, their fluted crowns pointing toward the sky like open beaks. Later, alone again and moving through his chores, he had been regretful, and sorrow had made his arms heavy, and he had dropped the bucket of water he was lugging from one end of the room to the other, which made him toss himself to the ground and scream with frustration and remorse. At dinner, he was unable to eat. He looked for Luke, wondering when and how he would be punished, and when he would have to apologize to the brother. But he wasn't there. In his anxiety, he dropped the metal pitcher of milk, the cold white liquid splattering across the floor, and Brother Pavel, who was next to him, yanked him from the bench and pushed him onto the ground.
"Clean it up!"
Brother Pavel barked at him, throwing a dish rag at him.
"But that'll be all you'll eat until Friday."
It was Wednesday.
"Now go to your room."
He ran, before the brother changed his mind. The door to his room, a converted closet, windowless and wide enough for only a cot, at one end of the second story above the dining hall, was always left open, unless one of the brothers or the father were with him, in which case it was usually closed. But even as he rounded the corner from the staircase, he could see the door was shut, and for a while he lingered in the quiet, empty hallway, unsure what might be waiting for him. One of the brothers, probably. Or a monster, perhaps. After the stream incident, he occasionally daydreamed that the shadows thickening the corners were giant leeches, swaying upright, their glossy, segmented skins dark and greasy, waiting to smother him with their wet, soundless weight. Finally, he was brave enough and ran straight at the door, opening it with a slam, only to find his bed, with its mud-brown wool blanket and the box of tissues and his school books on their shelf. And then he saw it in the corner, near the head of the bed. A glass jar with a bouquet of daffodils, their bright funnels frilled at their tops. He sat on the floor near the jar and rubbed one of the flower's velvet heads between his fingers, and in that moment, his sadness was so great, so overpowering, that he wanted to tear at himself, to rip the scar from the back of his hand, to shred himself into bits, as he had done to Luke's flowers. But why had he done such a thing to Brother Luke? It wasn't as if Luke was the only one who was kind to him. When he wasn't being made to punish him, Brother David always praised him and told him how quick he was, and even Brother Peter regularly brought him books from the library in town to read and discuss them with him afterward, listening to his opinions as if he were a real person. But not only had Luke never beaten him, he had made efforts to reassure him, to express his allegiance with him. The previous Sunday, he was to recite aloud the pre-supper prayer, and as he stood at the foot of Father Gabriel's table, he was suddenly seized by an impulse to misbehave, to grab a handful of the cubed potatoes from the dish before him and fling them around the room. He could already feel the scrape in his throat from the screaming he would do, the singe of the belt as it slapped across his back, the darkness he would sink into, the giddy bright of day he would wake to. He watched his arm lift itself from his side, watched his fingers open, petal-like, and float toward the bowl. And just then he had raised his head and had seen Brother Luke, who gave him a wink, so solemn and brief, like a camera's shutter click, that he was at first unaware he had seen anything at all. And then Luke winked at him again, and for some reason this calmed him, and he came back to himself and said his lines and sat down, and dinner passed without incident. And now there were these flowers. But before he could think about what they might mean, the door opened, and there was Brother Peter, and he stood, waiting in that terrible moment that he could never prepare for, in which anything might happen, and anything might come. The next day he had left directly after his classes for the greenhouse, determined that he should say something to Luke. But as he drew closer, his resolve deserted him, and he dawdled, kicking at small stones and kneeling to pick up and then discard twigs, throwing them toward the forest that bordered the property. What, really, did he mean to say? He was about to turn back, to retreat toward a particular tree on the north edge of the grounds, in whose cleft of roots he had dug a hole and begun a new collection of things, though these things were only objects he had discovered in the woods and were safely nobody's. Little rocks, a branch that was shaped a bit like a lean dog in mid-leap, and where he spent most of his free time, unearthing his possessions and holding them in his hands, when he heard someone say his name and turned and saw it was Luke, holding his hand up in greeting and walking toward him. "I thought it was you," Brother Luke said as he neared him. Disingenuously, it would occur to him much later, for who else would it have been? He was the only child at the monastery. And although he tried, he was unable to find the words to apologize to Luke, unable in truth to find the words for anything, and instead he found himself crying. He was never embarrassed when he cried, but in this moment he was, and he turned away from Brother Luke and held the back of his scarred hand before his eyes. He was suddenly aware of how hungry he was and how it was only Thursday afternoon, and he wouldn't have anything to eat until the next day. "Well," said Luke, and he could feel the brother kneeling very close to him. "Don't cry, don't cry." But his voice was so gentle, and he cried harder. Then Brother Luke stood, and when he spoke next, his voice was jollier. "Jude, listen," he said. "I have something to show you. Come with me." And he started walking toward the greenhouse, turning around to make sure he was following. "Jude," he called again, "come with me." And he, curious despite himself, began to follow him, walking toward the greenhouse he knew so well with the beginnings of an unfamiliar eagerness, as if he had never seen it before. As an adult, he became obsessed in spells with trying to identify the exact moment in which things had started going so wrong, as if he could freeze it, preserve it in agar, hold it up and teach it before a class. "This is when it happened. This is where it started." He'd think, "Was it when I stole the crackers? Was it when I ruined Luke's daffodils? Was it when I had my first tantrum?" And, more impossibly, Was it when I did whatever I did that made her leave me behind that drugstore? And what had that been? But really, he would know. It was when he walked into the greenhouse that afternoon. It was when he allowed himself to be escorted in, when he gave up everything to follow Brother Luke. That had been the moment. And after that, it had never been right again. There are 5 more steps, and then he is at their front door, where he can't fit the key into the lock because his hands are shaking, and he curses, nearly dropping it. And then he is in the apartment, and there are only 15 steps from the front door to his bed, but he still has to stop halfway and bring himself down slowly to the ground and pull himself the final feet to his room on his elbows. For a while he lies there, everything shifting around him, until he is strong enough to pull the blanket down over him. He will lie there until the sun leaves the sky and the apartment grows dark, and then, finally, he will hoist himself onto his bed with his arms, where he will fall asleep without eating or washing his face or changing, his teeth clacking against themselves from the pain. He will be alone, because Willem will go out with his girlfriend after the show, and by the time he gets home, it will be very late. When he wakes, it will be very early, and he will feel better, but his wound will have wept during the night, and pus will have soaked through the gauze he had applied on Sunday morning before he left for his walk, his disastrous walk, and his pants will be stuck to his skin with its ooze. He will send a message to Andy, and then leave another with his exchange, and then he will shower, carefully removing the bandage, which will bring scraps of rotten flesh and clots of blackened, mucus-thick blood with it. He will pant and gasp to keep from shouting. He will remember the conversation he had with Andy the last time this happened, when Andy suggested he get a wheelchair to keep on reserve, and although he hates the thought of using a wheelchair again, he will wish he had one now. He will think that Andy is right, that his walks are a sign of his inexcusable hubris, that his pretending that everything is fine, that he is not, in fact, disabled, is selfish. For the consequences it means for other people, people who have been inexplicably, unreasonably generous and good to him for years, for almost decades now. He will turn off the shower and lower himself into the tub and lean his cheek against the tile and wait to feel better. He will be reminded of how trapped he is, trapped in a body he hates, with a past he hates, and how he will never be able to change either. He will want to cry, from frustration and hatred and pain, but he hasn't cried since what happened with Brother Luke, after which he told himself he would never cry again. He will be reminded that he is a nothing, a scooped-out husk in which the fruit has long since mummified and shrunk and now rattles uselessly. He will experience that prickle, that shiver of disgust that afflicts him in both his happiest and his most wretched moments, the one that asks him who he thinks he is to inconvenience so many people, to think he has the right to keep going when even his own body tells him he should stop. He will sit and wait, and breathe, and he will be grateful that it is so early, that there is no chance of Willem discovering him and having to save him once again. He will, though he won't be able to remember how later, somehow work himself into a standing position, get himself out of the tub, take some aspirin, go to work. At work, the words will blur and dance on the page, and by the time Andy calls, it will only be 7 a.m., and he will tell Marshall he's sick, refuse Marshall's offer of a car, but let him, this is how bad he feels, help him into a cab. He will make the ride uptown that he had stupidly walked just the previous day, and when Andy opens the door, he will try to remain composed. "Judy," Andy will say, and he will be in his gentle mode, There will be no lectures from him today, and he will allow Andy to lead him past his empty waiting room, his office not yet open for the day, and help him onto the table where he has spent hours, days of hours. We'll let Andy help undress him, even, as he closes his eyes and waits for the small, bright hurt of Andy easing the tape off his leg and pulling away from the raw skin the sodden gauze beneath. My life, he will think. My life. But he won't be able to think beyond this, and he will keep repeating the words to himself, part chant, part curse, part reassurance, as he slips into that other world that he visits when he is in such pain. That world he knows is never far from his own, but that he can never remember after. My life. Chapter 2. You asked me once when I knew that he was for me, and I told you that I had always known. But that wasn't true, and I knew it even as I said it. I said it because it sounded pretty, like something someone might say in a book or a movie, and because we were both feeling so wretched and helpless, and because I thought if I said it, we both might feel better about the situation before us, the situation that we perhaps had been capable of preventing, perhaps not, but at any rate hadn't. This was in the hospital, the first time, I should say. I know you remember. You had flown in from Colombo that morning, hopscotching across cities and countries and hours, so that you landed a full day before you left. But I want to be accurate now. I want to be accurate both because there is no reason not to be, and because I should be. I have always tried to be. I always try to be. I'm not sure where to begin. Maybe with some nice words, although they are also true words. I liked you right away. You were 24 when we met, which would have made me 47. Jesus. I thought you were unusual. Later he'd speak of your goodness, but he never needed to explain it to me, for I already knew you were. It was the first summer the group of you came up to the house, and it was such a strange weekend for me, and for him as well. For me, because in you four I saw who and what Jacob might have been, and for him because he had only known me as his teacher, and he was suddenly seeing me in my shorts and wearing my apron as I scooped clams off the grill, and arguing with you three about everything. Once I stopped seeing Jacob's face in all of yours, though, I was able to enjoy the weekend, in large part because you three seemed to enjoy it so much. You saw nothing strange in the situation. You were boys who assumed that people would like you, not from arrogance, but because people always had. And you had no reason to think that if you were polite and friendly, then that politeness and friendliness might not be reciprocated. He, of course, had every reason to think that, although I wouldn't discover that until later. Then I watched him at mealtimes, noticing how, during particularly raucous debates, he would sit back in his seat, as if physically leaning out of the ring, and observe all of you, how easily you challenged me without fear of provoking me, how thoughtlessly you reached across the table to serve yourselves more potatoes, more zucchini, more steak, how you asked for what you wanted and received it. The thing I remember most vividly from that weekend is a small thing. We were walking, you and he and Julia and I, down that little path lined with birches that led to the lookout. Back then it was a narrow thoroughway. Do you remember that? It was only later that it became dense with trees. I was with him, and you and Julia were behind us. You were talking about, oh, I don't know, insects, wildflowers. You two always found something to discuss. You both loved being outdoors, both loved animals. I loved this about both of you, even though I couldn't understand it. And then you touched his shoulder and moved in front of him and knelt and retied one of his shoelaces that had come undone and then fell back in step with Julia. It was so fluid, a little gesture, a step forward, a fold onto bended knee, a retreat back toward her side. It was nothing to you. You didn't even think about it.
You never even paused in your conversation. You were always watching him, but you all were. You took care of him in a dozen small ways. I saw all of this over those few days. But I doubt you would remember this particular incident. But while you were doing it, he looked at me. And the look on his face, I still cannot describe it, other than, in that moment, I felt something crumble inside me, like a tower of damp sand built too high. For him, and for you, and for me as well. And in his face, I knew my own would be echoed. The impossibility of finding someone to do such a thing for another person, so unthinkingly, so gracefully. When I looked at him, I understood, for the first time since Jacob died, what people meant when they said someone was heartbreaking, that something could break your heart. I had always thought it mawkish, but in that moment, I realized that it might have been mawkish, but it was also true. And that, I suppose, was when I knew. I had never thought that I would become a parent, and not because I'd had bad parents myself. Actually, I had wonderful parents. My mother died when I was very young, of breast cancer, and for the next 5 years it was just me and my father. He was a doctor, a general practitioner who liked to hope he might grow old with his patients. We lived on West End at 82nd Street, and his practice was in our building, on the ground floor, and I used to come by to visit after school. All his patients knew me, and I was proud to be the doctor's son, to say hello to everyone, to watch the babies he had delivered grow into kids who looked up to me because their parents told them I was Dr. Stein's son, that I went to a good high school, one of the best in the city, and that if they studied hard enough, they might be able to as well. Darling, my father called me, and when he saw me after school on those visits, he would place his palm on the back of my neck, even when I grew taller than he, and kiss me on the side of my head. My darling, he'd say, how was school? When I was 8, he married his office manager, Adele. There was never a moment in my childhood in which I was not aware of Adele's presence. It was she who took me shopping for new clothes when I needed them, she who joined us for Thanksgiving, she who wrapped my birthday presents. It was not so much that Adele was a mother to me, it's that, to me, a mother was Adele. She was older than my father, and one of those women whom men like and feel comfortable around, but never think of marrying, which is a kind way of saying she wasn't pretty. But who needs prettiness in a mother? I asked her once if she wanted children of her own, and she said I was her child, and she couldn't imagine having a better one. And it says everything you need to know about my father and Adele and how I felt about them and how they treated me that I never even questioned that claim of hers until I was in my 30s and my then wife and I were fighting about whether we should have another child, a child to replace Jacob. She was an only child, as I was an only child, and my father was an only child too, a family of onlys. But Adele's parents were living, my father's were not, and we used to travel out to Brooklyn, to what has now been swallowed by Park Slope, to see them on weekends. They had lived in America for almost 5 decades and still spoke very little English. The father, timidly, the mother, expressively. They were blocky, like she was, and kind, like she was. Adele would speak to them in Russian, and her father, whom I called Grandpa by default, would unclench one of his fat fists and show me what was secreted within. A wooden bird call, or a wadge of bright pink gum. Even when I was an adult in law school, he would always give me something, although he no longer had his store then, which meant he must have bought them somewhere. But where? I always imagined there might be a secret shop full of toys that went out of fashion generations ago, and yet was patronized faithfully by old immigrant men and women who kept them in business by buying their stocks of whirl-pointed wooden tops and little metal soldiers and sets of jacks, their rubber balls sticky with grime, even before their plastic wrap had been torn. I had always had a theory, born of nothing, that men who had been old enough to witness their father's second marriage, and therefore old enough to make a judgment, married their stepmother, not their mother.